Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
Giving you that lovely setup on FedEx. Stock at its highs, up 4%, still with about a 1.2% gain on some plans that it is looking to cut, about $4 billion in costs, and by copying a strategy of its main competitor. We're talking about UPS. You want to get to it?
Yeah, with the details is Thomas Black, Bloomberg News industrial, logistics, and aerospace reporter at Bloomberg News. He joins us on Zoom from Dallas. Thomas, great to speak with you. The news today, talk to us about it. Cost cuts, merging, what stands out for you?
They're the big transformation of their company to go from two delivery networks to one consolidated network over time. That's really the big structural news. The cost cuts, it's a big number, $4 billion and plus $2 billion more if they can get their network to run the way they want to. So it could be $6 billion in total out to their fiscal year 2027. So big numbers there. It could really move the stock. I think the hesitation on the stock move may be because investors want to see them really execute on this. There is some execution risk here. So we'll be watching for that.
I mean, this is all about improving and shoring up its margins, right? Because UPS has easily outpaced FedEx when it comes to margins. And to be fair, Thomas, I feel like when we talk about FedEx and UPS, we have to remember they're not really the same operating models, are they?
They're not. There's a couple of key differences. One is UPS does have that one unified network already. It's a unionized workforce. Mm-hmm. Which can work in its favor, even though the cost for employees is higher. But there's a lot of efficiencies that they gain. I think FedEx wants to go after some of that. The other thing to keep in mind is that FedEx is a much bigger airline. They move packages more by air. So right now, the market is pretty tough there because after the COVID sugar high, we're now getting back to a more normalized market where you're also seeing a little bit of competition from the belly cargo from the airlines as they fly more. So that market, the demand there is certainly slack, and FedEx is trying to adjust to that.
Is that the big difference in terms of the margin difference where UPS, even though it's got unionized workers and it pays a lot more to its drivers than FedEx does, is it that FedEx has all of those planes and there's a lot more air deliveries, that that's why their margins are not as good? What has been really the big difference that has made the two so different when it comes to the margin front?
That's part of the reason. Okay. The air business just isn't as a high margin business. FedEx loses some efficiencies with its contractor model. It pays third-party contractors to make that last-mile delivery at its ground unit. And so there's some inefficiency handing off packages to those folks and also communicating with them to make sure that they have the right vans and number of vans and drivers there in the morning to pick up those packages. They've had a little trouble with that. And they're constantly renewing the contracts there, and there's some churn. So they don't have as much control over the drivers because the contractors actually hire the drivers. UPS has a lot of efficiencies that it captures because a lot of times the folks that want to be drivers, first they have to work in the sorting center, in the warehouse, if you will, and load those trucks. And then if they do a really good job, then they might get hired as a driver because they make pretty good money and they already know the system and how it works and so forth. So there's a lot of efficiencies that they gain there.
Thomas and Maddie, you might not know this, but I actually worked for a day as a UPS driver when I was doing a piece here at Bloomberg. And it was, and the company kept reminding me how different it was that UPS, it's all their own workers. There's no, yes. You know, outsourcing in terms of deliveries. And they talked about the importance in that different model. The other thing I will say, they were so nuts about data. Every move a delivery person or pickup person made, everything was tracked, and they knew the way to, you know, turn make right turns so you didn't get stuck at lights. I mean, it was pretty obsessive and pretty amazing, but it obviously has made a difference in the company.
Yeah,
I looked really good in brown too. No, I really didn't.
I wore the uniform. You crushed it, obviously. I need you to dig up that video for me. But Thomas, I wonder. I mean, to Carol's point, is all of this the culmination? Is it FedEx moving to become a UPS to emulate UPS?
Well, I think the main difference is that they're going to try to do this without having a unionized workforce. They're going to keep those contractors. In fact, there was a memo by John Smith, who's head of the ground unit right now, telling its contractors, don't worry, we still need you, we're still going to use you. So they're still betting on that model. The CEO, Raj Subramaniam, talked about having a hybrid model where they'll have some employees and drivers on the payroll directly, and then they'll have the contractors, but they're going to try to combine them into one unit so that when a customer drops off a package, it just goes in a FedEx system and pops that on the other end without having, in some cases, you can have two delivery vehicles arrive at the same location, one from Express and one from Ground. They want all those packages flowing through the same system.
Hey, Thomas, how do you make sense of somebody who reports on a company that's doing, you know, massive cuts, $4 billion they're shooting for, and yet they do promise to raise their dividend? Is that kind of saying, hey, guys, we're on it, but we're going to make you investors, we're looking to make you happy again? How do we see that in terms of use of capital?
Yeah, that's a complex question. They didn't talk about job cuts today, really at all. They had announced about a 10% cut on some top management folks, and they have been letting people go in their freight unit. And with their contractor model, they really don't have that much control over the drivers on the ground. So it hasn't been massive layoffs so far, and they didn't talk about that. But then again, they are cutting capital expenditures, and they're shifting some of that money toward dividends.
Yeah.
They've talked about reducing some of that CapEx as a percentage of sales. And I think this is a new era for FedEx, because for many years, FedEx was always playing catch up to UPS. Mm-hmm. And UPS was the market leader, and FedEx has gotten very close to them on sales. But I think FedEx is saying, you know what, we're going to cool down on the CapEx. And we might not try to overtake UPS as the biggest courier, but we're fine with that because we're going to make more money and we're going to give some of that back to the shareholders. I think that's maybe the pivot point that we're seeing as well.
But 2 years ago, I believe FedEx was in a better position than UPS, partially because they pivoted quickly during the tightness of the labor market to hire a lot of workers. To what extent, though, did that end up being the thing that killed them today? Not killed them, but impacted their long-term profitability?
Well, this is where those two models really kind of showed how distinct they are. FedEx did have a lot of trouble trying to hire folks who handle the packages in the sorting centers. And in some cases, they couldn't handle all the volume. And that was a direct result of all of that labor shortage. Mm-hmm. UPS was a little bit protective because they do pay top dollar. Even for their part-time workers, they get full benefits. So the UPS didn't have as much trouble hiring workers. But you got to think that these companies swell up and they shrink down often, right? Every peak season they swell up, you know, maybe by tens of thousands of workers, and then they swell down. So it's not unusual for them to flex their workforce.
Right. UPS does it too, right, during the holiday season. And I will say that UPS will also, you know, if they need be executives during like the holidays, they'll be out there delivering if that's what they need to do. They step
up
and
do
it, right?
Great. Lately, they've been hiring what they call personal vehicle drivers, which are just people off the street, and they hire them and you know, give them a uniform and let them deliver packages. So that's been a pressure relief valve for them.
The uniform
as well,
is key. It sounds like, Carol.
Yeah. The uniform is key. The uniform.
As long as you look good in brown, right?
It was a lot of brown. Thomas Black, thank you so much for finding time for us. We so appreciate it. Yeah, be well. Industrial logistics and aerospace reporter at Bloomberg News on Zoom from Dallas.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern.
Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app.
Or watch us live on YouTube.
Well, shares of AI developer C3 AI soaring about 1 month ago, following a revenue forecast and comments by the CEO that were both upbeat and led to more than a handful of analysts raising price targets on the company. Last two trading days, though, a little bit differently, and I have seen the stock drop nearly 40%. In fact, yesterday it was the most ever in a single day after short seller Carisdale Capital alleged serious accounting and disclosure issues at the company. The company, meantime, put out a statement saying the short seller's letter was a highly creative and transparent attempt to diminish the stock price. So let's get to it. Joining us right now is Tom Siebel, back with us. He's the founder, chairman, and CEO of C3 AI and the firm's third largest shareholder. The stock, by the way, has almost doubled here in 2023. We must also note Carisdale Capital, one of nearly 30 short-selling firms being probed by the U.S. Justice Department over potential trading abuses. And the company's owner, Adrangi, saying early this year that the firm had not been contacted by any government agencies over investigation. Sam Adrangi is the head of the company, the chief investment officer. Tom Siebel, thank you so much for being here with us. What do you say to the short sellers? Well, first of all, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing okay, trying to keep up with the news flow. I wish it would get a little quieter. So let's get to what the short seller is saying. They're saying that you used highly aggressive accounting to inflate your income statement metrics in order to meet sell-side analyst estimates for revenue and certain profit metrics and to conceal a significant deterioration in your underlying operations. They put this in a letter to your auditor. What's your response to this?
Well, I think this was an enormously creative and successful effort by a notorious short seller who it's widely reported is under investigation by the Department of Justice and the SEC, okay, and has drug and alcohol convictions. And it's highly creative, highly successful to issue this screed that contains not a word of truth, okay, short the stock, publish this letter, knowing that it would move the stock. And I think yesterday this person made in excess of $100 million. So it was very creative, very successful attempt at what appears to be successful stock price manipulation.
So, John,
that is the story.
So, Tom, so the charges or allegations of this short seller that's saying that you guys are, you know, presenting yourself as being in a high margin SaaS software service businesses rather than one based on lower margin consulting. This is the letter they put on. Are you a consulting company or are you a software as a service business?
About 80 to 85% of our revenue comes from software subscriptions and 15 to 20 comes from consulting services. This person, this short seller alleges that we purport to get 99% profit margins off of our largest customer in Grange, which is Baker Hughes. And there is nothing in any financial statement that will support that. It's a complete fiction. And he says, because it's 99% margin, there must be something wrong with it. Well, he's subtracting apples from oranges to try to come up with some sort of nefarious act. He alleges that the fact that we have unbilled receivables is a very serious suspicious, and good software companies don't have unbilled receivables. And he neglects to mention, you know, the many, many companies like Salesforce, Datadog, IBM, Adobe, and Alteryx, SAP, all of which have many, you know, very large unbilled receivables. Unbilled receivables is just You know, something for which you've recognized revenue for which you haven't submitted the invoice yet.
Right.
It's very common in the industry. It's well understood. And he's trying to imply that there's something wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. It's proper accounting. But the guy succeeded. I mean, sometimes crime pays.
So it paid off
for this person in a big way yesterday. So we, you know, our hats are off to him.
So Tom, and I want to get into what you guys are doing in terms of AI, because that's initially why we asked you to come on. In terms of your accounting, Deloitte and Touche, they're the one who got the letters. You're comfortable with their accounting. You've talked with them. You're comfortable with their disclosures.
Our disclosures are correct. Our accounting is absolutely correct. We have unqualified opinion statements from our independent auditors. We have best practices in terms of accounting, in terms of audit committee practices. And that, I mean, this is just a bunch of poppycock. This is a trick that this character played on the market. And, you know, he made somewhere between $100 and $200 million at the expense of C3 shareholders yesterday.
And no regulators have reached out to you, or that firm hasn't reached out to you?
They have not reached out to us. And while it's widely reported that these guys are under investigation by the SEC and the Department of Justice for stock price manipulation, we've not been approached by either of those regulatory bodies about this firm.
And have you been buying any of the shares on the downfall?
Me personally or C3?
Both.
I have not been buying stock in the market. As you know, the stock is up about, I think, 100% year to date. Okay. And it's been, we've reported in our earnings announcement that, you know, business is quite good and the business climate is quite good. And my only hope is that this short seller in particular, and the short sellers out there, hold on to their stock, because they're going to get, in my opinion, they're going to get crushed.
Real quickly, and then we'll pivot to AI, I promise. How do you refute the short seller's argument that part of your success and gains is related just to the ticker name and the overall hype around AI right now?
I mean, that's just a silly statement. I mean, I think the name AI, I mean, I think there's no value probably attributed to that. The fact that we're in the AI market, I think that, you know, a rising sea kind of lifts all boats. And so we are clearly a leader in enterprise AI. Enterprise AI looks like a $500 billion addressable market in not very many years. C3 AI is in a position to establish, if not the leading position, a leading position in that market. So there's no question that some of the upward pressure on the stock is due to the realization of the size of the addressable market opportunity that C3 faces.
And quickly here, I just wonder, as CEO, how do you not get seasick on these market moves? Because you had all of these gains, then obviously a tough couple of days here. What is your thinking around strategizing for your long-term goals despite the market volatility?
It's very easy. I ignore the market and focus on the long-term goals. Our business is to build a great company, have satisfied customers, have a cash positive, profitable business, market leadership position. And, you know, if we do that, we can just look. We have, I think, last quarter, something like $850 million in the bank. So we are unquestionably an ongoing concern. And I think if we focus on the big picture here, stay focused on the big picture, I think this will work very, very well for the shareholders. But we don't really look at day to day or minute to minute or even month to month. I think, you know, as far as we're concerned, the market could close for 5 years. But I think this is going to, think this is going to work out very well for the shareholders, the employees, and the customers in the long run. And that's my job. So the reason I don't get seasick is I don't look at it.
So Tom, just got about 35, 40 seconds here. So, I mean, what is the big win for you guys in the next 6 months that you say, hey, listen, short sellers, you've just so got it wrong?
Oh, I think that if you're on the short side of this year, I mean, our business is good. Okay. And we're in a position to, you know, we recently transitioned to a consumption-based pricing model that's really well received by the market. We expect to see, you know, as the Fed, when the Fed gets ready to take its foot off the brakes, mm-hmm. okay, as it relates to dealing with inflation, I think you're going to see C3 as a very rapidly growing market leading enterprise application software company that's profitable, cash positive, and that'll be reflected in market valuation.
Tom Siebel, thank you so much. Of C3AI, as we said, a lot of analysts upgrading this stock last month.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do, that's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, we've got just about 17 and a half minutes left in today's trading session, getting ready to wrap up on this Wednesday. Remember, it's a holiday-shortened trading week. We do get the jobs report on Friday, but financial markets here in the U.S. are going to be closed for the Good Friday holiday. Having said that, bouncing around here on the equity side, gain in the Dow just about 0.25% higher, as Charlie mentioned. Tech stocks in particular, the NASDAQ down the most on a percentage basis, but it's really a big focus on what's going on in the Treasury trade right now. That two-year note, just a reminder, 378, 10-year note with a yield of 329. So let's get to it with our Drive to the Close guest. And with Maddie and me is Bill Davis, portfolio manager at Hennessy Funds. Bill, specifically managing the Hennessy Stance ESG large cap ETF, ticker is STNC. Fund up roughly 4% year to date. Bill with us now on the phone from Boston. Bill, great to have you here on this Wednesday. Tell us a little bit about the fund, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you guys made the debut, was it like when we were kind of coming out of the pandemic?
Yeah, hey, Carol and Maddie. That's right. We actually launched the fund in the first quarter of 2021. So STNC is a NYSE listed, actively managed ESG large cap ETF. And we've basically got 2 years in the actual ETF itself.
And assets under management, what kind of flows have you been seeing? And I'm really curious in particular the last, let's say, 6 months or so and more recently, just to get an idea of investor sentiment.
Yeah, I would say that flows have, well, so last year we basically, even though the market was down 18%, I think we were down 12% and change, and our flows went up by about 10%. So we've got about $45 million in the fund today. We are expecting some inflows. Some actually potentially significant ones, really just based on track record and outperformance and risk management. And I think this is a market where risk management matters.
Well,
I want to talk about the fact that it is an ESG fund, and Carol has flagged this, and we've talked about it a lot. ESG funds falling out of favor a bit, garnering more and more scrutiny. The absence of consistency in ESG classification showing the hurdles investors face when trying to allocate capital, especially given these macro headwinds. But against that backdrop, MSCI has said it's planning to dramatically reduce the number of funds it gives top ratings. And I wonder how you're feeling about those changes that are going to take effect by the end of this month.
And are you feeling any impact as a result?
Yeah, so no. Short answer, not feeling any impact. I think that ESG as a political wedge issue is largely a dead end as a sort of an investor sentiment issue. I think that there are a wide swath of investors, institutional, high net worth, ultra high net worth, mass affluent, millennial, you know, people with $10 to invest and people with $100 million to invest who care about these issues, or they don't, right? So, I mean, I get that there's people that don't care about them, but the people that do are not being dissuaded by congressional inquiries into, you know, ESG. We have not seen any effect whatsoever. And by the way, I actually do welcome the idea of additional scrutiny. There are too many products that are either me too or, you know, just lack authenticity. And I do think a weeding out of the general landscape would be a very good idea.
Well, and part of the big problem is, you know, every ESG fund, it's not apples to apples. There's inconsistency, to say the least, in terms of classification. So how do you, we want to get into your picks, but how do you define ESG? You're an actively managed fund. So what says ESG to you before you, you know, that requires you then?
Really good, really good point. And by the way, I will also say there are a lot of valid approaches to ESG that are very different from what we're doing. Like, I could make an argument that you could have an ESG product that invests in energy transition, right? So that's mostly investing in today's oil and gas companies, trying to pick the winners and losers in the transition to a lower carbon economy. Our particular product, this product, STNC, is fossil free, it's weapons free, it's tobacco free. And really then what we look to do is invest in the intersection of good ESG and good fundamentals across as much of the economy. And I should point out our market universe is the S&P 500, so we're basically U.S. large cap. But we are, you know, we happen to be overweight industrials frequently. And so we are not afraid to invest in segments of the economy within which the transition is not only important, but there are going to be inherent risks for companies and their investors when they aren't being ambitious enough in that transition. And so we think that there's real opportunity for investors to generate alpha there.
So talk to us some names here and what your KPIs are for those stock picks.
So we have 24 KPIs. I'm going to start by saying that.
Key performance indicators for everybody.
Yes,
go ahead.
Thank you. Key performance indicators. Sometimes we call them material risk factors because I think really what we're trying to do is on an industry group basis, identify those material risk factors and then weight them in according to importance. So like a practical example of that is automotive products. We get asked pretty frequently about Tesla and you know, we try not to let personal feelings, you know, get involved in decision making. And what I will tell you is Tesla is very good at certain things like low carbon or carbon transition, but it happens to be very bad at a lot of the S&G stuff like governance, injuries and fatalities, human rights, worker rights, those things. In the end of the day, Tesla sometimes is in our portfolio because it happens to be in the top 50% of its industry group, largely as a result of what it's good at and as a result of the weighting of what it's good at. And that's essentially how the KPIs work for us. And some are E and some are S and some are G.
Unfortunately, we only have about 40 seconds left here. Pick your name. MasterCard, we know you like. You've also recently taken positions in GE and Alphabet. You can pick one and just tell us why. And again, only about 35, 40 seconds.
Yeah, well, I'll take GE as an example. I mentioned sectors that we like. We tend to like industrials. We tend to like healthcare. We happen to be overweight in financials for the first time. Mm-hmm. But GE is kind of an interesting name because it plays in both industrials and to a certain extent healthcare. It's a strong ESG name, and there is a very strong signal right now around news sentiment, which is not typically a big signal for us, but right. Fundamentally we like it as well, and we think it's a good time to own it.
Yeah, if you're thinking about Catalyst, I mean, shares of GE, by the way, they're up about 43, almost 44% so far here in 2023. Great conversation. Bill Davis, thank you. Come back soon. Portfolio manager at Hennessy Funds, joining Maddie and me on the phone from Boston.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.